Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Hey, it's Adam Carolla. You may know him from putting his body on the line in Jackass, but now Johnny Knoxville is bringing you the wildest stories from the bravest folks he knows on his newest podcast, Pretty Sure I Can Fly. With his co-host, Elna Baker, they have incredible firsthand accounts from folks who surfed 100-foot waves, ride 600 miles per hour in a rocket sled, and wrestle crocodiles just for fun. They've been talking with brave souls who throw caution to the wind and push the boundaries of what humans are capable of. Or, as Johnny would say, they're talking to people who have more balls than a bowling alley. I'm Pretty Sure I Can Fly. Johnny and Elna bring you personal stories from unsung heroes that are part comedy, part adrenaline, and all heart. These are the inspirational, hold my beer stories that will make you want to grab the bull by the horns, literally and figuratively. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly right now, early and free, right now on Wondery Plus. Oh boy, we saved the best for last, man. Rob O'Neill, the guy who took out Bin Laden. Not the guy next to the guy behind the guy, or the guy who was supposed to be the guy that took out public enemy number one worldwide. Boy, his tale. Very graphic, very interesting, very moving, but man, when he told it, you were there. I mean, it was like getting off that helicopter, that compound. So we'll look forward to that in a second. First, I'll tell you about TradeStation, man. You want a little extra edge? Want to find your next great trade? Easy-to-use tools for traders of all skill levels. Simple pricing. Stocks at $5 a trade. Options at 50 cents per contract. Plus $5 per trade. Futures, $1.50 per contract per side. No software fees. Free real-time market data. Free premium tools. Take a fresh look at TradeStation by doing what? I'll tell you how. Go to TradeStation.com/Carolla. Again, no software fees. Free real-time market data. Free premium tools. You trade smart. You trade confident. You go to TradeStation. TradeStation.com/Carolla and get going, man. The stock market's hot. Let's get in. We'll make a little hay while the sun is shining at TradeStation.com/Carolla. All right. Without any further ado, and I don't say this very often, American hero, Rob O'Neill.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, the author of The Operator, Firing the Shots That Killed Osama Bin Laden, Rob O'Neill. With Gina Grad on news and Bald Brian on sound effects, and now, he never was a Navy SEAL, but he did dress up as a sailor once for Halloween, so, hero, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on the treasure. Get on mandate. Get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Good day, Gina Grand.
Good day to you.
And Bald Brian.
Cool.
Is that sunny?
It is.
Oh, boy.
Enthusiastic.
Cool. Normally, we bring our guests in about the 45-minute to an hour mark, but Robert O'Neill here has such an interesting story.
You don't make a man like this wait.
No.
Yeah, I don't want to upset him.
The Operator, Firing the Shots That Killed Osama Bin Laden's name of the book, and my years as a SEAL team warrior, available now on Amazon. You know what to do. Just bookmark us and click through our site. It's called Win-Win. Good to see you, Robert.
Thanks for having me, Adam. I appreciate it.
So I got so much to talk to you about. We can go through the mission. The thing I was kind of interested in as well was involved with the rescue of Captain Phillips, too. Saw the movie about with the pirates and everything. 400, am I right when I say over 400 missions in a 17-year Period?
Yeah, just about 17 years, 400 missions, four different theaters of war technically, but some of those were before 9/11. I joined the Navy in 1996. I became a SEAL right around 97, started deploying from 1998 until 2012. So it was a long career, about 400 missions, actual combat missions in that time. So yeah, and fortunate enough to be part of the team that was picked for a lot of the high-profile ones towards the end. So that was kind of – it was different from before where no one really knew what we were doing and we were just hunting bad guys and it turned into the high-profile stuff and big rescues and stuff like that. So very interesting career.
Yeah, sorry. Dylan wrote here in 1995, so that's why I did my – incorrect math.
No, it's about right. It's
you're in 96. So do they work your team like they work the officiating team for the Super Bowl, where they take the sort of the best guys or the best crews that, and they move them to the big game
that
you
was
get the high-profile stuff?
For the big mission, that's how they did it. It was we were at the right part of a rotation. We just finished a combat deployment. We were just back and training. And because that crew could travel and train without being really noticed, they picked the best guys from that crew. So that was kind of how it is. They picked 28 guys. We ended up going with 23. Before that, for Captain Phillips, we just happened to be the guys that were in place. There's a certain rotation. You're either at war training or standby. We were on standby. So we got picked to jump in after Richard Phillips. And then I was a part of the team that rescued the lone survivor, Marcus Luttrell. That's just because we were overseas at the time, happened to be in the right place there too. So a lot of luck involved, a lot of hard work to get in the place to be lucky, but that's kind of the way it went down.
Is one of the criteria to have a really strong cleft chin?
Mm,
it seems important.
Thank you.
How many movies have you been portrayed in, you or your team?
There were sort of four because they did American Sniper and we were in the same place, but we weren't working with that SEAL team.
Did you know Chris Kyle?
No, I didn't. I actually was going to, we were going to meet up. And he was killed right before we were going to meet up. He actually sent me something very cool. Right after the Bin Laden raid, it was still fresh in my head and I wasn't sure how to, I don't know how you absorb that.
Sure.
And I got a book, American Sniper just come out and I got a book sent to me and someone told me it was autographed. And I remember thinking, why would I want an autographed book from another SEAL? And I opened it and on the first page, it said, "Great shot, Chris Kyle." And I was like, well, there's the coolest thing I own. That's pretty neat.
That's
I still have that.
Well, so here's how you know everything you're going to hear from this point on is going to be true, because we asked Robert if he knew Chris Kyle, and it could have been super easy for him to go, oh, we hung a little when we're in theater and country or whatever, but he said, I didn't know him, which now everything else that comes from your mouth
everything
will be
else
truthful.
Is honesty.
Well, you could have easily fudged that. You're in the same area doing the same stuff. None of them would have yelled liar at you if you said you had a couple of sandwiches with the guy and did a little powerlifting. It was a cool dude. Like, no one could ever vet that. So the fact that you said didn't know him, well, now we know everything's going to be true.
So American Sniper, obviously, Zero Dark 30.
Yes. And then
Captain Phillips, I'd assume.
And then Lone Survivor.
And Lone Survivor, okay. You've seen all the films?
Yes.
Can you rank them in terms of accuracy, how much maybe you enjoyed or responded?
Accuracy is a tough one. I would say Lone Survivor, because my initial thought there was, if you want to know what a gunfight in the mountains of Afghanistan looks like, that would be it. And what it feels like to have something shoot past you or slam next to you and just be like, where did that come from?
It was so visceral.
It was a great movie. My only complaint about Lone Survivor was the mountains weren't steep enough.
Mm.
And you can only they filmed it in, I want to say, New Mexico, which has some pretty serious mountains. But in the eastern Himalayas, in the Konar province of western Himalayas, eastern part of Afghanistan is.
I didn't want to correct you. I was about to dive in.
And then what's funny, too, is I'll get asked about Captain Phillips, which is a good movie. I like it a lot, and they made SEALs look good. But it's not accurate. It's a 70% accurate. Unless I get asked at happy hour by some women, I'll say, well, it's 100% accurate. I took all three shots. All depends on where we're at. No, I wasn't one of the shooters there, but okay. They did a good job with that. I like Zero Dark 30. I can pick apart tactics all day long. And then American Sniper was really good at depicting the PTS that comes with a lot of deployments and how they responded. I wasn't a big fan of the fake baby scene. Do you guys see that part?
Yeah.
I spotted that right in the theater, and it's like that.
Took you out a little bit.
But good, yeah. Good stuff.
But all good movies.
All good movies.
Have you? I'm sorry if you haven't. I didn't already. I don't know. But have you consulted for movies?
No, I have not. Not on any of them yet. But there'll be more that comes out. Hopefully, I hope so.
So when you see a modern day sort of gritty, tough movie about the theaters you were in, you look at those and go, that's pretty close. I mean, that's the way they dress. That's the way they talk. Or
the way they talk, they did a really good job in American Sniper, especially with the comedy aspect of SEAL training. When the instructors are yelling at them, just destroying them verbally, but stuff they're saying is really funny when you look back on it. Yes, I had instructors that were like that. They did a good job with that. And again, Lone Survivor was more serious than all of them. And then even with I'm assuming with Zero Dark 30, because there was a government agency that found him, and there was actually a group of women that found him, and they were spot on as far as I could tell, as far as how serious, 100%, he's in this place, and we know it, we found him. So there, I'm sure each part of every kind of movie has certain parts that are really realistic, and some that you kind of, that's not what happened.
But I feel like, and I have nothing to compare it to, but I just feel like those, you know, the old John Wayne movies of yore just didn't accurately depict what life in battle was, let's say, like. And these new ones feel, if anything, I guess, are they even sometimes too gritty? Do they feel like a little overdone, or is that,
no,
that about it?
They're pretty good. I mean, there's never the guy running through a house to jump through a window when an explosion almost catches him type stuff. But I think that the John Wayne type movies where everyone was brave and no one's afraid and we'll rush the hill, and that's all nonsense.
Right.
I don't think people are like that. There is an emotion factor that comes with it. And you know, and then there's the not necessarily fighting for whomever is in office at the time. It's fighting for the guy next to you. Yes, we believe in the overall effort, but right now I'm fighting this house for him.
I want to – hey, Gary, look up Audie Murphy. No, Audie Murphy?
No, the name.
I loved him in Raw.
Audie Murphy.
Well done.
See what you did there?
That was Eddie Murphy. Funny. Audie
Murphy.
It
sounds like Eddie Murphy.
Audie Murphy is the most highly decorated soldier in the history of combat, I believe, isn't he?
He's up there, and he had a big Hollywood career. So he,
this is one of the most.
One of the most, and then he was.
He received.
Hold on, just go ahead and do your Audie Murphy thing. But so he's a highly decorated soldier. And then he came back and started doing war movies. And I don't know when he died or what the story was. It's interesting how these. I don't know
71.
His name was Audie. Is his name?
Yeah, A-U-D-I-E, and he died in 1971 at age 45. I'm still doing some research as to how.
Damn early. And then we got to find out, did we remember right? What did he get? What was he decorated with? And then did he do a bunch of war movies as soon as he came home? And then why the hell did he die at 41? Yeah. All right, hold on. How about some On It? Let's get healthy in the new year. You heard me talk about On It before. Amazing supplements like Alpha Brain, Buffalo Meat Warrior bars, MCT oil. And by the way, all those bars with all the nougat and drizzled and fudge. And don't monkey with that. Not good for you. Talk to Uncle Vinny about that. The Warrior bars, those are good. The MCT oil. Ask Dr. Drew about the MCT oil. How about we talk to Aubrey Marcus? Yeah, he's the On It CEO. And he'll tell us all about his experience with ayahuasca. Listen, man.
You know, I had an experience. It was about the 10th time where ayahuasca took me down this path where it was like, you know what? Not only you're going to die, it's that you never mattered. It's like, mm-hmm. You're nothing. You're the gum on nothing's shoe. You're water borrowed from the ocean and the ocean forgot. You're completely worthless. And so I had to surrender. Like, even in my death, I had some idea like, well, I lived well. I'll leave a legacy. Some people will remember me. I was like, nah, bitch, you're nothing.
Anyway, they filmed the whole thing. You can take a look at the behind-the-scenes mini-doc at onit.com/Adam and get 10% off. They have a whole bunch of great supplements and equipment, everything. Just go to onit.com/Adam. Get 10% off your entire order. onnit.com/Adam. All right, Gary, what about Audie? And why did he die at 41?
45.
No.
I'll get there.
In 71.
Correct. Born in June of 1925, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. He dropped out of school in the fifth grade to help the family. He was born to a family of sharecroppers. And after the attack on Pearl Harbor, his older sister helped him falsify documentation with his birth date to get into the armed services. Turned down by the Navy and Marines, so he enlisted in the Army. Over the course of World War II, he received every military combat award for valor available from the U.S. Army, as well as French and Belgian awards for heroism. He also received the Medal of Honor for valor, demonstrated at the age of 19 for single-handedly holding off an entire company of German soldiers for an hour at the Colmar Pocket in France in January 45.
Using magic,
and then,
to be fair.
And then
they were mesmerized. It worked.
Sleight of hand.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it took, yeah.
You might be right, because he then led a successful counterattack while wounded and out of ammunition.
Wow.
Hey, Made it on something.
I like the idea that you have to start expanding into other countries to take their medals.
Exactly.
Like, I got everything the U.S. has to offer. We got to move into other Axis powers.
Belgium?
Yeah.
He did then come back after the war and enjoyed a 21-year acting career. Played himself in the 1955 autobiographical film To Hell and Back based on his memoirs. And beyond that, he was largely in Westerns. After suffering from PTSD, or what would today be called PTSD, he suffered in the last few years of his life, was plagued by money problems, but refused to appear in alcohol and cigarette ads because he wanted to be a good example. And he died in a plane crash in Virginia shortly before his 46th birthday. He was interred with full military honors at Arlington.
It's weird. You escape all of that death for so long, and then you just die in a plane crash. Such a weird, weird life. God. All right. You're not flying anytime soon, are you?
Yeah, I pretty much fly every day.
I saw your bags packed out
what's,
there.
What's unique about it is I don't avoid alcohol and cigarettes, so I'm not too worried about crashing.
Oh, good. Yeah. Your odds are evened out.
Shrewd.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
How long did you have to keep quiet about all this where you could, you know, write a book, give interviews, that kind of stuff?
Well,
even talk to family.
When we finished the mission, we flew back from Bin Laden's house to bases in Afghanistan. Then we left later that night. We flew back to Virginia. By the time we got back to Virginia, it had pretty much gotten out that I had done it in the SEAL team. So in Virginia Beach and in San Diego, and then it spread up to Washington D.C. I had friends that I had work in the White House call down and talk about me. So it kind of got out, and it wasn't really natural. It wasn't a normal thing because it was never. I didn't do the mission. You know, the analysts found them. The pilots don't get enough credit for flying there and saving everyone's life on the first helicopter that crash landed. The people that led the mission up the stairs, the guy that jumped on the suicide bombers that he thought, you know, I just got the shot. So it wasn't comfortable to be like, hey, look, this guy killed Bin Laden. And it never did get that way. I did eventually get out of the Navy and then through some memoir, I did public speaking, never about Bin Laden, just about success and why we were successful. And I was writing my memoir, and I submitted it to the Pentagon, and they said, and I put the Bin Laden stuff in there. They said, yeah, okay, it's good. So this is the first book about especially that mission by someone on the ground that's been submitted and approved by the agencies involved in the Pentagon. So that's kind of cool. So short answer is 5 years.
So I want to walk all the way through the process and the story in the evening and all that, if you don't mind.
Don't mind.
Good. So where are you when you hear that I think they used this carrier and spotted him or found where his compound was. When do you first hear the news, and how long from the time you hear that to the time you're getting into a chopper?
Well, they were tracking his courier who was taking messages from that house to parts of Pakistan to call people for about 5 years. They didn't tell us till about 2 weeks before, but they knew about it. They'd been briefing certain people to include the president and different parts of the military. They brought us into a spot maybe three and a half weeks and told us about a mission, but they didn't tell us what it was. Mm-hmm. And they were being ambiguous about everything. We assumed we were going to go to Libya after Gaddafi because it was the Arab Spring. You know, it was April of 2011, all the uprisings in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, things like that. So we're going to go get Gaddafi. Then just through certain briefings over the next few days, we figured out it was going to be in Pakistan. It had to be Bin Laden. And then they took us down to a place in North Carolina to train. And they told us that day – actually, the famous woman came in, the one they called Maya, and she said, the reason you're here is you're as close as you've ever been to Osama Bin Laden. And so we prepared for about 2.5 weeks, but we knew it was Bin Laden we were going after for that time.
So you're doing this in North Carolina.
Yeah.
They have his compounds sort of mocked up there?
Yeah. They built up the exterior – out of chain link fence and like Connex boxes, the big storage type crates. And it was pretty much the exact exterior, which is good because you don't want to know what the interior is because as soon as you get there, it's wrong. Always has been. No one knows what the inside looks like. Just let us go in.
I'm guessing it was tasteful, whatever it was, but we don't know the exact lay of the land.
But we were able to train on it with helicopters, come up with the perfect plan, and then as many contingencies as we could, even to include talking about, well, what if the helicopter crashes? So we talked about that stuff. And we worked on that day and night, 10 to 14 hours a day, and then we'd stand around a model of it that was exact, just not to scale, and we would talk about everything. And then, you know, a day with the family, then back out. We went out west. I'm not sure if I said in the book where, but there's a training site out near here. We trained for a few days, and then we went back to Virginia another day with our kids, and then we decided we're going to launch to Afghanistan to wait for the green light from the president. So we waited there, and they told us the Friday before, for sure we're going. We left on Sunday.
they knew. So they said they'd been kind of tracking him for 5 years.
Yes.
Why such a long cool down period between the time they sort of knew where he was to the time they actually acted on it?
I don't think they knew he was. They were onto something based on trying. They knew the guy that they found in a certain part of Pakistan was making calls for him, but then tracking him back to that house took a number of years.
Yeah, they never got a visual on him, right? Like, he never left the house.
No, he never left the house. And this guy did, and they couldn't find it because he was always using his phone from a moving vehicle. So it's very hard to track, especially in certain parts of Pakistan where if you don't look and sound like you're from there, you're not welcome there. They're gonna mess you up. But they eventually tracked him back. They found the house. They started watching, and they noticed one guy walking around inside of the compound. They called him the Pacer. And he was taller than everyone. He was wearing different clothes. And when people were doing the normal tasks, like tending the garden or working with the animals, he would walk past them, maybe stop and say something, but he never stopped to help. So
right.
Someone important. He's never leaving the house, and he comes out. This entrance goes back up, and then they start looking at it closer with people on the ground. Certain walls are certain heights. You can't see in. You can't see out. They always burn their trash. Something's going on, and you know, very smart people figured it out. The best people that the agency had were figuring
how,
it out.
How central to wherever anything was happening was this compound? Like, you heard – I guess we heard about sort of hiding in plain sight, but – how remote was it, or how central was it? How much was going on around it?
It was in a fairly remote part of a resort-type city, as much as a resort you can get in Pakistan. It was near a golf course. The
Palm Springs of Pakistan.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Their version of West Point was a mile away, and it was at the end of a road that dead end. So it's not like just through traffic, but houses were being built up around it the whole way. There's a neighborhood around it, and you know, by the time we got there, it was pretty built up. It was there was even a guy outside as we were leaving who was outside with his phone tweeting. Why is the – we saw him. I saw him. He was that famous dude. If you look it up, he was tweeting, why would the military be running exercises on a Sunday night?
What and so
– that's crazy.
Yeah. What percentage of the neighborhood, if any, suspected or knew he was in there?
I wouldn't guess the neighborhood necessarily did, but the Pakistan Intelligence Service definitely did. They probably put him there.
So they were in on it. They knew about it.
Certain parts of it were. I'm not saying necessarily the Pakistan military was, but the intelligence services definitely knew he was there. And they have a vested interest in keeping al-Qaeda a little bit at bay because they're not their friends necessarily, but they don't want al-Qaeda attacking them. So if they turn over bin Laden, maybe they attack them. And but we knew without a doubt that if we tell the Pakistanis we're coming in and we're going to do a joint effort, he wouldn't have been there. Mm. They would have taken him out. Wow. He would have, not taken him out. They would have
removed
yeah. him from there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's too bad. It's funny because you hear about all the leaks coming from the White House all the time, mm-hmm. every day, and you realize these guys didn't leak anything.
I don't think anybody knew. No, I mean,
but the intelligence, the Pakistani intelligence knew, right?
Oh, as far as
they weren't leaking. You'd think there'd just be a weird rogue. Someone would get drunk.
You
and,
would
like
think.
Just say
well,
something
even,
to somebody
even for money because what was there right. $50 million reward on his head?
Yeah, I mean, like, what do you? I we can't assign a number to it, but were we talking about dozens of people that knew and just would never said a word for all these years? I mean, it seems it's like if somebody knew who killed Nicole Brown Simpson and it wasn't OJ, like wouldn't you that right. guy get drunk and talk or say yeah. something at somebody? I mean, like, this is how I know
Pinky
there's no
swear.
Other there's no other killer because that guy would have said something to some yeah. hooker he was banging when he was drunk.
I've seen Shawshank Redemption. I know how it
right.
happens.
You know yeah. how it works. I'm surprised that these
yeah
more
too.
A group of people is able to sit on this mm-hmm. for forever with again the huge yeah $50 million reward.
It just tells you where the – well, I mean, it worked with the Hussein's sons, Uday and Kusay. Their uncle figured out, you know, $25 million to pop, and they're in the same house. I know where they are. I'm gonna tell someone, and then my ass is moving to Dearborn, get a mansion.
So is that where he's living?
I think so. I'm assuming so.
What a country. As the great Yakov Smirnoff once said. So you simulate the compound. There's two choppers. You're in chopper one or two.
I was in two.
And one's job is to do what, and two's job is to do what?
The first one's job was to hover in between bin Laden's house and the guest house, which is in the front yard, and put everybody out on fast ropes, which when they hover, snipers protect them on both sides, and then the guys fast rope down, then the snipers come down, then it leaves. We were going to land outside, put other snipers down and the dog handler and then an interpreter, and put our team on the rooftop of the main house, if that makes sense, so that we can have an assault team going down while another one comes up, and you can kind of pinch them in there.
Right.
That was the perfect plan that lasted for about 3 seconds. The first one crashed. We didn't know it. The pilot knew it, so he just dropped us all off outside. So then we had to start on the way in. But we knew what to do. We knew what was going on. We just didn't know the helicopter crashed. I didn't know until I got inside the house.
What caused the helicopter crash?
The pilot told me, and I'm not a pilot, but he said there was some sort of Areolas effect, meaning an updraft, that it couldn't hold a hover because I think it was – the weather was warmer than we thought, so the air was thinner and it couldn't quite cut it. And the air off of the fence, because we were training on chain link fences and these were mud, and it just said it had a different effect. And the pilot actually said if a lot of inexperienced – less experienced, and he was the best in the world fortunately – would have tried to power up and make a racetrack, but he knew if he did that, he'd flip it and kill everybody for sure. So he just put it down. He actually didn't crash it. He landed it, but he just pinned it against the wall and the ground so it could stick. And
right.
That's why it didn't roll. It was really, and that, you make that decision in less than a snap of a finger.
Right. So he's a less he's a good experience dude. Would have said, I'm dropping full throttle. Let's go up and get out of here. But it would have rolled.
That's what he said to me. That's
right.
And I could be wrong, but that's what the best pilot in the world explained to me.
So now you're outside.
Yes.
And how many guys are inside? How many guys are outside?
I want to say we had 13 and they had 12. Is that right? No. 11 and 12.
11 and 12.
They had 11. We had 12 and a dog.
And how – now you got to get from outside to inside.
Yeah, so we knew just because the pilot landed us – because he did go to take us to the top, and he saw the other helicopter go down, so he just brought us back. So we just –
Now, was the dog a comfort dog because one of the
therapy
folks
dog.
Were scared to fly in a chopper?
We were very concerned about microaggressions when we got
yes.
there. So we didn't want them to kill us with that or magic.
Or a macroaggression. They shoot
at this point, that's a macroaggression.
So
he was there for his nose. If somebody ran, he could chase him. He could find him with his nose.
Oh,
so his job was initially to get there and do a loop around the whole thing to make sure nobody could leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they put us down on the outside, we just knew where there were entrances. So we went to put bombs on the closest one was on the northeast corner. So we went up to that thing, put a huge bomb on it. It blew up and it opened in like a tin can into a brick wall. Like it was a wall. It was a fake door. And that's when it starts to click. It's like, wait a minute. This is a fake door. There's someone inside. He's in here.
Right. So,
but now we have to find a new door because that didn't work.
Right. So they mocked up yes. basically a door like yeah. Wile E. Coyote would use.
Right. We were actually joking about that, like in the Bin Laden house, going down a hallway, it gets smaller and smaller, and you're just Bin Laden.
It's painted on.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that had to. I mean, at the time, you could have thought, well, maybe some weird eccentric, maybe. Maybe the version of Phil Spector was living there, like just some sort of weirdo rich guy who,
some recluse.
Never left his house and was tall or whatever it is. But when you see the fake door with
Play
the
with
brick,
guns, gold records everywhere.
With the brick behind it, this is somebody.
Yeah, like, they didn't just accidentally find this house of someone who happens to be just a freak and nuts. We at that point, we knew it was going to be probably, top five Al-Qaeda.
Right.
But still, it's Bin Laden.
We don't know it's Bin Laden. So now, how do you breach it? How do you get
well,
in?
We knew there was another door. It would have been to our right, and it was a carport, and we'd seen it open.
What time is this?
Probably about 2 a.m. local time.
And how much ambient light is there?
There was 0% illumination. That's why we went on that day. There was no moon.
So, and that's in your
that was
favor.
Part of the reason we launched then. If we didn't get it that night, we skipped Saturday. There was two nights of 0% illumination. We skipped Saturday because of the correspondence dinner in Washington. Because if we launched that and all of a sudden the cabinet gets up and leaves all the presses there, what's going on? They're going to start digging. So we launched on Sunday. And that was it. If we didn't get that, then it would have been wait 30 days.
So you make your way to the right. You're wearing the night vision goggles.
And we didn't know the other guys were inside. We thought they had flown off.
Uh-huh.
And so we announced to them that we were going to blow the carport. And they said, no, we'll just open it. And the door opened and a thumbs up came out. And that's a point where I'm a big believer that if something happens, you don't need to worry about why. It just happened. We need to do something else. We'll talk about why it happened later. I didn't know why the guys were in there, but they're in there. Doesn't matter. They're there. I don't care. So we went in and we're just kind of – I remember looking up at Bin Laden's house. My guys are already in there. There's already gunfights going on. And just thinking, wow, this is cool. This is Bin Laden's house, man. We're probably going to die tonight, but I'm going to take this in. This is historic.
So what – you say thumbs up. Do you guys have a signal or a call or something? Because in the chaos
– Well, that would have been – that it's making calls and yelling makes the chaos more chaotic. Just a thumb.
Oh my God!
Well, like,
when you're
watching movies and stuff, and you hear that one jackass just yelling, "Go, go, go!" It's like, calm down. We're going.
Right.
We're all gonna go. Everyone, take a wrap up. Stop yelling at me. But yeah, just a thumb came out. It means we're good. And then so we just, I knew that part of my team's job was to go into Bin Laden's house. So I knew it was to the left. Go to the left, and then we're at the bottom floor, and I'm watching. And it was, I was very fortunate to have not gone to the rooftop, because now I have a front row seat to the greatest mission that ever happened. I'm in the back watching. I'm not doing much. I'm just chilling out, watching guys do their job, you know, the way they're breaking in doors, going from mechanical breaching to explosive breaching, moving people around. And then they got to the end of the bottom floor where they're trying to breach a door that's barricaded that we know goes to a set of stairs. And so we know we want to get up. Bin Laden's probably in this house.
How do you know it goes to a set of stairs?
It's got to. It's a three-story house. And we've already cleared the entire bottom floor.
So there's no other door to open.
No.
And this one has to lead. And it's the most fortified.
It's yes. And that's when, again, it starts to say, okay, why would this be barricaded? And we just – on the bottom floor, one of the guys killed the courier, and his wife jumped on top, and she was killed. And one of my guys was worried. He's like, well, she became a human shield. And it's like, don't sweat it. She's a martyr. Like, this is, again, another sign. This is something big is here. They're trying to martyr themselves.
She jumped on
top. She tried to jump in front of him in the gunfight to block the bullets.
Oh, I don't feel like my wife would ever, ever do that. She'll give my son, like, the rest of one of my sandwiches going, he's hungry. And I go, well, what about me? Forget about diving in front of.
Navy SEALs come into your house. And
wow, I have to really rethink my relationship. All right. Nightfall, History's new scripted drama series, Nightfall. Wednesdays, 10 o'clock on History. Oh, man, History's really come a long way. They're doing some kick-ass work now. Set in medieval France, tangled in politics and conflict, one courageous Templar knight will lead his order of warrior monks on a life-or-death mission to find the lost Holy Grail. Tom Cullen from Downton Abbey. He leads the cast, taking viewers deep inside the most powerful and mysterious military order of the Middle Ages. So let's review. Nightfall, History, great scripted new drama, Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Remember, it's like my grandpa used to tell me, he who controls the grail holds the power. Nightfall, Wednesdays, 10 p.m. only. On History. All right. So, Robert, now we're in the compound and we're in the three-story home that's within the walls of the compound. We breach every door and there's one left. It's heavily fortified. How many folks would you say you came up against on the first floor and on the premises?
People that were trying to fight us were two guys. So two guys had their guns up. One got a full, I think, 30 rounds out of his magazine, shot through the door. He missed, and he was eliminated by some of the guys. This is in the guest house. The guy on the bottom, I don't know if he got a shot off, but he definitely raised a weapon, and one of my guys from outside shot through the window and killed him, and that's the one that had the wife try to jump in front of him during that fight. Other than that, there was probably between 15 and 20 women and children. And that's just a part of separating them, you know, putting them in one spot and like leaving a person on them because they're not a threat really. They can be, but they're generally not. And then we're just looking down the hallway to a door that's barricaded, and there's already two guys down there working on that problem. So they're going through their systems. Just, you know, they eventually got some explosives on it, and then the door opened, and then we found the stairwell. It's right inside that the door that opened.
So at this point, you know, Bin Laden is probably here.
Yes.
And obviously he's now awake. And are you thinking, what is he thinking? Or are you thinking, does he have some sort of jet pod or something to escape? Or is he taped TNT to himself?
That was the most likely. We even in the rooms that I would go in, I would look around the ceiling to see if there was any explosives that were hanging from the ceiling, because that's the best way to bring a house down if you're going to demolish it. And that's a tactic a lot of guys would use in this spot, was a improvised explosive device in a house and you know, an HBID. And there weren't any. So we assumed the suicide bombers are going to be on the stairwell and then in the bedroom, and he's going to have a vest on too.
Well, that's the part that really ups the ante, because if you're going after, you know, the drug kingpin in Central America, that guy just wants to live so he can long enough to see his kids and bang another hooker at some point, and doesn't really, you know, if he goes to prison, it'll be a prison that he built. He'll be you know, bringing in professional soccer players to hang out with and do coke and stuff. Like, that guy wants to live. So when you're raiding that guy's compound, that's got to be a totally different thing than raiding a compound of a guy who you assume is going to go out a martyr.
Being a martyr, they definitely, that is one thing they want to do. But there's also a very interesting part of it that someone at like Bin Laden's level or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's level is they believe, and I'm not making this up, that it's almost, the more people, they only get one life to give to Allah. But if they can give more lives, like if they can convince people to kill themselves, they get like a little piece of it. So maybe he was thinking, if I get captured, I can go, be on trial in New York for 10 years and just, you know, bring the jihad that way and encourage people to do it. I was assuming he's going to blow himself up, but I wanted to get up there to see it. I wanted to make sure we got him, and I know it's him. And we had accepted death on this mission anyway. I just want to make sure that it's him. So we're going up the stairs, and we also knew that we'd run into his son on the stairwell, which is the analyst from the CIA told us that we would run into Khalid Bin Laden. She said, I don't know where the stairs are, but when you find him, somewhere between the first and third floor, Khalid will be on the stairs, and he will be armed, and he's his last line of defense. And if you get rid of him, the big guy's next. So we kind of went up the stairs.
How do you think she got that intel?
I have no idea. She was one of the best in the world, but she knew he'd be there. And she turned out to be 100% right on every single person in the house.
Is this the Jessica Chastain character, yes, essentially, from, yes, the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that's our point of reference.
No, right. That's exactly who they made the movie about. Right.
Yeah. Just minus the 80 pounds, but yeah. But other than that, the triple chin, but she knew. She knew. Yeah, like graying around the roots.
But yeah, no, I mean,
the skin condition.
Understood.
The thoughts of the house coming down on us, blowing up, that was what kind of made it really cool, was nobody was afraid in the house. I was watching my guys. I remember being proud of them and how cool they were. And like, no one's hesitating. Everyone's doing their job exactly. And the way I describe it is slow is smooth, smooth is fast. That's what the guys are doing. And I watched them do it. And we got to that stairwell. I was like seven guys back in the line going up. And we saw Khalid, and he sort of jumped behind some cover, like a banister. And he was armed, and it was quiet and dark. And normally, you know, I would have taken some guys back, because if he throws a grenade, you don't want to fight up. So if they throw stuff down, it's bad. But I remember being there thinking, I have to watch this. I need to see how – there's two grown men separated by 10 inches that want to murder each other. I got to see what happens. And the point man, just as cool as ever, he whispered, Khalid, come here, in two different languages that he knew Khalid knew. And Khalid came around the corner and he said, what?
Wow.
That was it.
And he shot him?
He got him in the face. The guy was still armed, so he's a threat. But he just – a little trickery. I didn't know how he was – I wouldn't have thought of that. But I was like, man, this guy's either a – great SEAL or a great criminal or both, because that was some tactics right there. That's like Jedi stuff. Oh,
do you think Khalid – well, first off, I guess it's now 2-something in the morning,
yeah,
Sunday night. This guy's probably watched football, had a few pizza.
Sure.
And they're probably had a few brewskis, sure, and they're passed out. You know, and I'm like Sunday night, especially during football season, at 2 a.m., I don't know where I am.
There is no deeper sleep.
Was he – do you think he thought, well, now I'm going to die? Or do you think Khalid thought, no, I know somebody, this has got to be familiar?
I think what happened,
the inside man or something?
I have to assume what happened is our tactics were so good, we were so quiet. No one's yelling in English, no one's saying a word, that they don't know who it is. I mean, it could be it could be anybody.
Right.
Maybe it's the Pakistanis coming to move us.
Right, right.
So who knows? I mean, there was gunfire, but I mean, there's gunfire a lot of those places.
Right.
And so he confused him. And that was it. And then at that point, you know,
so we now Khalid's gone.
Yep.
And we've confirmed that it's Khalid.
Now it's
like
Khalid.
Visually.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're looking at pictures.
No, we just, as we stepped over him, we're looking at him.
Yeah, I know. But before that, you looked at pictures. Mm-hmm. And so you go, that's him.
That's him. Now Bin Laden's up here.
Now, since everything that all the intel you got from the Zero Dark 30 gal has been right up until this point, yep, you're assuming whatever happens after this point is going to be correct as well.
Yeah. I was convinced he was there anyway. Before we went, just because of her, I was convinced he's on the third floor of this house. There was no doubt in my mind. And so, it's easy to say now because he was, but she was very convincing. She was very good at what she did.
And so you're also worried about blowing up the building, him being a martyr, suicide vest, but you figure there's not a lot between you and him at this point.
Right. And that's – so after we got Khalid – and again, I was like 7-8 guys back. We got – that was in between the first and second floor. We got to the second floor, and that's when everyone went to the left and right, because you need to clear the unknown spaces. So they went to clear the rooms on the left and right of the second floor, and that's when I became the number two man behind the point man.
Right.
So now we're looking up the last set of stairs, and there's a curtain at the top of it, and it was like acting as a door.
Is there any light on inside?
No, nothing.
Zero light.
Nothing.
but you're wearing the...
We have night vision, so right. we can see. And now, because we know that it's bin Laden, and we know he thinks something bad is happening, we're assuming they're putting on suicide vests, and behind the curtain we can see. And that's when the point man started... He didn't know it was me, but started talking to the guy behind him. Because I had positive control of his shoulder, just to let him know he's got guys. And when I squeeze, it means we have enough. That's, again, communication without talking.
Right.
So he just started talking, though. He's like, hey, we got to get up there now. Because he thinks we can beat him to the vest. Like, if we can get up there and kill the suicide bombers before they clack, we might live.
Right.
And so he kept saying, he was so convincing that – and I just didn't have enough guys. It was just him and me at this point. But then I remember – I don't know what he was thinking because he's just a bad dude. But for me, it wasn't bravery. It was like, we got to get this over with. I'm really tired of thinking about blowing up. So I'm just going to go find out. So I squeezed him. And he went up the stairs through a curtain, and there were – people that turned out to be women, but he didn't know right away. He just assumed right. they were suicide bombers. So right. he grabbed them and tackled them down the hallway, like to absorb it, like when they blew up, which is amazing. He jumped on a grenade that didn't go off. And because he went that way, I turned to the right, and then 3 feet in front of me is bin Laden standing there. He's got his hands on his wife's shoulder, and he's sort of pushing her towards me. And so I saw him, positive ID, and the way that my thought process went was he's taller than I thought. He's skinnier. He looks older. His beard is short. It's gray. That's his nose. That's him. He's not surrendering. He's a suicide bomber. I got to kill him. So I shot him twice as he was standing up and one more on the ground. And then – so he's done. And then his wife was right there. I pushed her over to the bed. He died at the foot of his bed. I pushed her over to the bed. His three-year-old son was standing there. And I remember as a father like just thinking – you know, this poor kid's got nothing to do with this. It's a shame he has to see this. And picked him up, put him down. And that's when other SEALs are coming in the room and they're clearing. And then I was sort of standing there. And a guy came up to me and he goes, hey, man, are you good? And I said, yeah. What are we supposed to do now? And he laughed mm-hmm. and he goes, well, now we find the computers, bro. We've done this hundreds of times. And I said, oh, you're right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm back. And he said, yeah, you just killed bin Laden, man. Your life just changed. It's like, wow.
Was, wow. All... God, I felt like I was there. Is so.
But you like you worked on a you did some podcasts today, and I think you worked on the car a little bit. So you guys are basically even.
Kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Same day.
Yeah, we're here.
It was dark in the garage.
I paid a guy to work on my car, but yeah.
Can you? Is it possible? Can you satisfy my curiosity? Because one of the best, and again, the point of reference for all of us, you know, mortals, is the movie, you know, Zero Dark Thirty. Mm-hmm. There was that great moment that cut the tension. Just it pricked the balloon just enough when you I see your character and the other Navy SEAL are going up the stairs, and the one guy, you know, it's a white knuckle at this point because you know bin Laden's next, and all of a sudden someone, I assume either you or someone, says Osama.
Yeah, but see, we said Khalid.
I know,
but
I didn't know if it got kind of transposed.
No, the people that help with the movie, I think they were SEALs, and they kind of let their imagination roll.
It's definitely very dramatic on the screen, I will say.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Oh, no, it was. But no, it was never – I didn't whisper it, and I didn't hear okay. it be whispered. And nobody from the mission helped with the movie. Good movie, again. But the way it went down was so fast.
Sure. Like,
I didn't even get to say anything.
I'm curious.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so it's like when you have these – impressions of somebody, but it's like when you see a celebrity in real life, mm-hmm. you go, that guy's taller or older or better looking or younger, whatever it is. You have these, like,
yeah,
you had that with a
skinny, oh, yeah,
yeah, you had that, but taller, skinnier, yeah, older, all in a millisecond in the dark,
yeah,
pretty much.
One that stood out was the skinny and older. Because you see him on TV with the darker beard and it's full beard, and he looks kind of like a young, just tall, skinny. Old.
Yeah. Well, so now that's about him. But like when you enter these things, all your senses are going, and they're going, they're all at 10. And so there's smells and, mm-hmm. and other visual things that you pick up. And I'm curious, I'll tease it a little bit. What did you pick up just being there? Like, this guy sleeps a lot. This guy's a slob. This guy loves porno. This guy loves curry. You know what I mean? Like, when you walk into somebody's... It's like, you know, you ever borrow someone's car? The second you get in their car, you're like, oh, man, what radio station?
Yeah,
oh, this guy, oh, he smokes. This guy smokes. I mean, oh, the air freshener. Yeah. Oh, he's a Gatorade
gum
guy.
Wrappers,
oh, who drinks this brand of Gatorade? Why would he drink that? Like, you immediately just start all, like they tell us, like, oh, you can't judge and you can't profile. Jump into someone else's truck and borrow it. I did it today.
Oh, yeah,
I went on a lumber run today and I jumped in a guy's truck and all I did was profile. Like, why is he wearing his seat so far back? His seat, he's not that tall. Why is it tilted back? Isn't that good for your
posture? It's a lot about a guy from his compound and or the way he keeps his car.
just the radio station it's on and everything mm-hmm. else. So I'm just teasing that because I want to know. You must have had a flood of that when you entered his area.
Initially, I was surprised at how much it looked like a house in Iraq. It looked the same. They slept the same. People on the floor, families together on beds on the floor. But after I was done, what impressed me was how organized he was as far as running Al-Qaeda. Because he had three business centers downstairs, computers, towers, thumb drives, hard drives, all kinds of stuff going on. And then the just copious amounts of opium that were in there.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, they're in these huge sea bags. Like
the duffel bags.
Yeah. And we open them. And at first I thought they were.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I got it.
Cheese V. It's a joke, but good name for cheese V. Seabag.
I thought they were vacuum sealed ribeye steaks when I first looked at them. I mean, my initial thought was, wow, they're in it for the long haul. They got steaks here they can cook. Then I started looking, and it's raw opium. And then you start to think, okay, they're not smoking this or whatever. They're funding Al Qaeda with this. So they have this computer set up, all the propaganda. You can see where he'd watch stuff, and they're sending out mess. Even the porn that we found, there was embedded missions on the porn.
Wow.
So they're not in there for the.
You can write it off that way.
It's obvious. Yeah, the
tax implications.
Is he the
ISIRS?
he's working. He's not hiding. He's working.
He's running it.
He's running Al-Qaeda from
that. And they're a lot more organized than people realize, and they're not done either.
All right, so Robert, now, I love this story. My God, I'm so into this. So you're now Bin Laden's dead, and you must have this sort of surreal, dreamlike feeling. And then training kicks in, and it's back to reality, and now it's time to start getting computers and
Well, now it sinks in that we wanted 34 minutes on the ground. How much time we've been on here? Let's get as much as
we can.
It's
like robbing a bank, like one of the cops.
Well, seriously, but now it's because before it was all right. You want to take it in, absorb it. It's historic. We're going to die. Now it's like, hey, we can live. Let's get our stuff and get out of here.
So 34 minutes is what you had
total. That's what we want. Well, initially, because of the first two helicopters, that much fuel could get us in and out, we thought. But now, because of some of the stuff that we did, we had other helicopters with extra fuel in certain spots on different mountains. But we want to get off the ground because we're not worried about the Pakistan military, but we don't want to kill a bunch of Pakistan police because that turned into a national incident. You know, we can do it, but we don't want to.
What time are you at by now?
I would say probably right around 15 or 16 minutes. And so but there was so much stuff there that we wanted to get as much as we could. And we ended up getting a treasure trove. We got so much out of there. And we ended up killing, not us, but the U.S. military killed a lot more high value guys because of what we found in that house. But, you know, we're trying to get the positive identification from the people on target, trying to get a little DNA to confirm because we want to tell our superiors, hey, it's him. Just in case something happens, we get surrounded, we can tell eventually, maybe through negotiations, look, we told you if we found him, we're coming to get him. So chill out, everybody. You know, we don't know, but we're trying to make sure we're covering all the bases, and we need another helicopter to come in because we need to blow up the other one. Even though the pilot said he thinks he can fly it out, we're not taking a chance. Sure. Like, you had one shot at this, you crashed. I'm kidding.
So
this is clear.
You have to destroy the copter that's
in the front yard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like when a horse breaks its leg or something. Like, technically it's alive, but you got to put it down. You have to put it down. Why?
We wanted to try to get rid of it so they couldn't find any of the technology. If we couldn't fly it out, we can't leave the entire helicopter there.
Right.
And we did a pretty good job, except a part of the tail fell over the wall. That's the part that the Pakistanis got and inevitably sold to our dear friends the Chinese.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. So that's
slightly
why I have
used.
To do it.
Previously owned.
So you have to throw the explosive satchel in there and just blow it?
Yeah, we had two of our bomb guys go out there, and they just in the interior, they put certain bombs in certain places, thermobaric type stuff, just to blow it, try to burn it, incinerate it.
Mm-hmm. And so I never even really thought about that. It's one of those parts of movies that they never seem to cover.
The cleanup.
Ooh. They scuttle ships all the time, but they don't.
They did it in Black Hawk Down when they brought the helicopter. Point. They tossed a couple grenades in there.
Oh,
it was a downed helicopter, and they.
I never thought about it from a technology standpoint or a sharing of technology. But so we know the one is damaged, and maybe it'll fly out, maybe it won't. But we're not going to make that decision.
Blow in
we're
place.
Just going to blow in place. Mm-hmm. We have other helicopters that can come get us. Mm-hmm. Who is identified? I mean, you visually identified Osama bin Laden, but who? How's the DNA work?
We had a guy on the mission that even because we had already sort of drawn down a special operators from Iraq, and for some reason this guy decided he wanted to keep learning Arabic, And everyone made fun of him for doing it. But because he taught himself Arabic, when we flew over, we picked him up and grabbed him. So he got on the Bin Laden mission, having not even been on our team, which is pretty cool. So he ended up talking to some of the daughters and the wife and was asking about him. And they finally admitted to him. They said, yeah, that's him. That's Sheikh Osama is what they said. So that was confirmed there. And then with the pictures that we sent that we do have that the conspiracy theorists will eventually see whenever some politician decides it's important enough to get reelected to show people the pictures. Right. But we did have him. And that's when we gave the Geronimo call to our bosses to let the president know that we got him. And now we're going to bring him out.
So do you have a body bag with you?
Yeah, we put him in the body bag and four of us carried him out.
Okay. And so you and three other guys?
Myself and three other guys, yeah. We carried him down. We put him out in front of the – it was interesting too because we put him – the guy, the sniper outside is the guy we put him next to. And he was the sniper that initiated the fire on the pirates to rescue Richard Phillips. So it's like here's a guy here and he's – oh, by the way, he's on this one too. It's like small world.
Yeah.
But we brought him out and said, hey, here's your guy. He's like, you're kidding me. He's like, no. He's like, let's get out of here. So that was kind of how that went down. And then we split up. We put the body on one helicopter, and then we took the DNA and the rest of the guys on the other helicopter, and we flew out.
Right, in case something got hit or one got hit.
Yeah, the redundancy. Because now my team's not in a – doesn't have the stealth technology. It's a school bus flying out. So we have 90 minutes to fly out, and they know we're there. And a surface-to-air missile, especially from someone like Pakistan, is designed for a jet, and it just goes after a helicopter. You're done.
Right.
So now we have 90 minutes to think about that as we try to get to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm.
How many people were left in the house and what happened to them?
All of them. Maybe, I don't know the number. It's available somewhere, 20-something.
And were they of no concern at that point?
We just left them, and we knew Pakistan would be there soon enough, which they were, and they kind of rounded them up and then interrogated them and tried to find out what we knew. And didn't we tell you not to tell the Americans about this?
So are you leaving with hard drives, computers? Oh,
everything we could find. Everything, because like, we would find everything. Hard drives, electronics, everything we had in bags, and now we have it all, and we're flying out with it. Stuff we could fit in our pockets. I had a hell of a time carrying that sea bag full of opium out.
and are you, at the time, you don't know what's on the hard drives or anything?
No, we're just trying to get it. We know someone smarter than us will get to it.
But does someone smarter than you share what's on that at some point?
Yeah, a lot of it's available now. They've released a lot of it.
But with you, did you have to wait for the rest of the public?
We had to wait for them to go through it. Because as soon as we got back, we turned it over to the law enforcement intelligence types.
But do you have to wait till we all find out about it for you to find out?
No.
Or do you get a little bit of a
We
head?
Probably would. If it's something that had to do with our team and a specific place where we could be sent, then they would tell us. But a lot of it, they'd, you know, the whole need to know thing is just because, I mean, it's not that it's too secret. It's like, you really don't need to because it's not going to affect you.
All right. A million more questions to go. We need to take a quick break. The book, The Operator, Firing the Shots That Killed Osama Bin Laden, and my years as a SEAL team leader, available right now on Amazon. Robert O'Neill is here. Take a quick break. Be right back after this. Robert O'Neill here. I love all these stories. I've had a couple of people on hold for a million years, so I just want to blast through them, and then we'll get right back to my question is going to be Al-Qaeda and where they are now, and what's ISIS, and what the hell is the difference between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and what's going on in the world right now? But first, I'll talk to John 32 from San Pedro, California. John?
Hey, get it on, Ace Man.
Get it on, man.
Mr. Bald, Miss Gina, Mr. O'Neill, thank you for your service, sir.
You're welcome. Thank
My
you.
My pleasure.
You're no sir, Bald Brian.
That's true.
What's going on, hey, John?
You know, just with all the Congress stuff, man, you hitting it out of the ballpark, the documentaries, the racing, the race cars, your family. You know, we all strive to do your best. I just wanted to know, when was the last time that you thought you didn't do your best?
I do think about this because I try to put myself, I don't know if you guys ever do this, but you know, I deal with like 29-year-old dudes or 25-year-old dudes, and I end up saying, I'm like, what the hell were you thinking, man? Like, what? Come on. How is this going to work? Or what did you think was going to happen? Or how did you think this was going to work out? And then I realized I could kind of remember really specifically when I was installing closets and I was like 27 and I was putting up some like aluminum track for the sliding doors in front of the closet, and I cut it a little long and I started to kind of try to push it up, and I sort of like take a block and whack on it and start to get bent up, and I kind of like straightened it and I whacked it up again. But it was like a horrible job. And I got back to the shop and my boss was like, the owner's on the phone. the track looks like shit. What did you do? And I remember kind of thinking, yeah, how did I think this was going to go down? Like, I knew this was going to look bad. I knew they were going to call. I knew it looks like hell. Like, you can't avoid it. And I remember thinking, that's how I was wired when I was 27. But I don't know why I left the person's house not thinking they would come home and right. go, this looks like crap. What are we doing? I paid good money for this. You have to come back and fix it. And my boss was kind of looking at me going, it looks like crap. Like, why'd you just leave? And I remember just kind of thinking, going, I don't know. I don't know. That I'm 27. That's where I'm. That's as far as I can get. Wow. So every once in a while, so that's the last time I screwed up. But no. No, I do sometimes when I'm looking at people, especially younger people, and I'm going, what were you thinking? Like, how do you think this was going to go? Like, why do you think this was good? Didn't you think I was going to come home and see this and go, what's going on? Like, this looks like crap. You need to fix it. And they just go, I don't know. I don't know. I think to myself, that's what I was thinking when I was 27, when I was leaving this guy's house with this bent up aluminum track that they paid good money for. So I get that. Something like Congress, I could have screwed up because I didn't prepare. So I didn't do my best, but it ended up turning out okay.
You did your good enough.
I did my good enough. And no, it was not preparing, but it turned out good anyway. So that little bullet dodge.
Wasn't there a race not so long ago where you didn't I said rehearse. You didn't run like the trial run and like you sheared a something or something came off or something.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think. I
had knee surgery and I said I'm doing a race the next day and I ended up hitting a concrete barrier. That's good.
I feel like Robert getting a lot of mileage out of Adam has a catchphrase, don't do your best, do my best.
Do my best. Yeah,
I feel like Robert getting a lot of mileage out of that.
One of the things I was thinking about when you were saying that was there's two ways to do things. You can do it the right way or you can do it again.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Awesome.
And then if you wanted to do something well, do it 1,000 times, you'll be good at it.
I like that too.
I like this.
Yeah.
And what was the one earlier? I'm sorry, the fastest.
Slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
Love that.
It's good. Hicks, yeah. Hicks makes ways.
Tell the men folk that.
All right, one more.
Horseplay leads to sick bay.
Oh, another good one.
Time to lean, time to clean. That was at the McDonald's in Studio City. Someone said they saw the Ray Kroc story.
Excellent. The founder.
The founder said it was good. Said time to lean, time to clean was like absolutely behind him in some part. No, I didn't see it yet.
Oh, really good movie.
It is very
I've seen it twice. It's awesome.
I want to see it and...
It's a great movie. I happened to watch it last night. It's definitely in there.
Underrated because it didn't get any like any award.
No fanfare.
It's why Time to Lean, Time to Clean. It confuses people, but it was in my McDonald's when I was 16 in Studio City. Sierra, 28, Nashville.
Oh, hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
I'd like to thank Mr. O'Neill for his service.
Thank you for saying that. You're welcome.
Okay, so I've lived in 6 different states. I lived in Los Angeles, Seattle. Most recently, I lived in Virginia for 3 years, like a small, conservative, God-fearing city. And I noticed that there's way more catcalling, so much more catcalling. Like on the East Coast, like you go to Boston, like you walk down the street, way more catcalling. And
on the East Coast, on East Coast than West Coast.
Yeah.
Okay, I have an answer.
That's a good observation.
This is like construction sites.
No, like I'm talking like not even construction sites. I'm talking like guys hanging out, cars, yelling.
Dudes on the street.
Like, dudes on the street. Okay, but and construction sites and dudes on the street.
Possibly construction sites, but
I know you want desperately to have heard of encountered this.
Anyone who's ever held a hammer.
Just figure every movie I see where there's a cat call, it's on a construction site where they go walking past and the guys are all like, doing that.
I'm walking down the street with my dog, young man leaning out the car windows, yelling.
Okay.
Like every single day.
On a construction site?
And I would get,
On a mobile construction site?
Yes, and.
Was the dog wearing a tool belt?
Sierra, yes, and.
All right. Have you dropped a considerable amount of weight? I have two theories here.
No, I've gained weight.
All right. Interesting. Okay.
She's gone up in the inner city.
L.A.,
Yeah.
Okay. Here's my L.A. feeling. It's also I'll weave it into Robert over here. I always have this theory that Al Qaeda and ISIS are never going to hit L.A., and the reason they're never going to hit L.A. is because you're not killing the blue-eyed devil over here. You're killing a bunch of brown people.
You're not
from,
killing Robert O'Neill.
You're killing, like, poor brown people. Like, you would kill, if you set off something in L.A., you'd kill a whole bunch of non-whites, and then your biggest allies, who are over in Malibu, the celebrities that are cheering for you, those guys would actually get pissed off because you killed all their housekeepers and gardeners. So, L.A., not a good tactically not a good target.
Is this your Ernest Bigot?
Ernest J. Bigot.
Ernest J. Bigot.
From last week.
You're working out the material.
Well, you want to kill the blue-eyed devil, not the poor brown guy who's come here just to get a job at a bakery, you know, working under the table. So, L.A., I think, doesn't have a lot of white dudes walking the street. I feel like they're just at home or in a double-gated community. It's just the whole vibe. Like, you go to New York, you'll see the extras from Saturday Night Live going up and down the street.
That's true.
You go to L.A. and walk up and down the street, do you see anybody who looks like Denny Terrio coming at you?
No.
Or John Travolta circa 1979? Like, you just don't see those guys. Those are the guys who do the catcalling. Mm-hmm. The Mexican guys and the Filipino guys and all the other Asian guys and all that, they're not the big catcalling crew. I think it's a cultural problem. I think in Boston, you got a bunch of white guys walking around.
Higher concentration.
Yeah, you go to L.A. and just walk through downtown or whatever. You do not see a bunch of red-haired guys walking at you, look like the Wahlberg brothers.
Although, Sierra, did you say you lived in New York for a period of time?
No, I did not. But I visited a lot of East Coast.
Okay. Did you ever notice, because I lived there, and this is something that doesn't happen anywhere else. I don't know if it was a Puerto Rican or Dominican gentleman, but they would hiss at you. Mm. That's the thing. There's a lot of hissing. There's
a frightened cat.
But that's instead of like, ooh, it's hissing.
Oh, you know, this reminds me of something that I wish I wasn't reminded of.
More salacious. Mm.
You know how we do this thing where we can't stop bringing up meaningless event or topic du jour, and then we drill down on it. We go, it's all over the news. It makes a cycle for 3 days, and then it's gone. Like to bring up Cecil the Lion and the Who Gives a Shit department, but we have to bring it up. Remember 3 years ago, some chick made a catcall video about her walking through the streets, and half of the catcalls were guys going, good afternoon, or how you doing, or good day, or something. She was counting all the greetings as the catcalls do, and that made the whole cycle, and now it's been 3 years. Mm-hmm. Are we thinking about it? Has it come back to haunt us? Is this part of our daily ritual, or is it just another thing that idiots jumped on, decided it was a news story when it wasn't a news story, and now it's gone again? But the theme's always the same. Aren't we horrible? It was another one of those, oh, we're so horrible. Look at her. She walked down the street, and guys said, how are you doing? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That chick was crazy, too.
Of course she was. No, she's not crazy. The news is crazy for treating it as news. It's not news. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. It happened so much. And, like, I've lived in Seattle, like, which is pretty dang white, you know? And, like, you walk down a street in Seattle, and, like, they don't bother you. So I'm walking down this really I have a theory. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Like, I think that men in the West, like, their masculinity has been suppressed more. And I think living in a very conservative kind of, you know, traditional kind of town, young guys, they're given a little bit more. They're allowed to be kind of guys, you know. That's my theory.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Or construction site.
Well, no, I mean, you could probably walk up and down the streets of Santa Monica all day, every day in a thong back. I probably wouldn't have one catcall because of the constituency.
You were likely to get a sassy gay guy going like, you go, girlfriend, or you know, whatever the gay call is.
Yeah, man. All right, Sierra, glad we cracked that nut.
Thank you,
man. All right. What was that stupid video? Remember, we all had to discuss it.
And so she obviously knew the guy who was walking in front of her because he had some sort of a nanny cam in his backpack, which is why it seemed like it was a
candid
but
this is a big news story because guys were saying, how you doing? Or hello, lady, or whatever. Some were just greetings.
Lady. Capes. Rob, are there any female Navy SEALs?
No.
Have there ever been any?
No. They're in the process right now of trying to select women who can potentially go through.
I thought there was two.
There are. They're in the early stages. I'm not sure how that's going for them. I did work with females in combat before in a different role, and they did some of the missions with us, and I was very impressed with them. They weren't necessarily the people kicking in the doors, but they did the long, 5 mile hikes through those swampy, snowy, crappy Afghanistan mountains with us, and I was impressed with them in gunfights with them. Who knows? I'm a big believer that if you don't lower the standards and they pass them, I mean anybody. Have at it.
Anyone who can do it, do it.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I mean, a very, very few percentage of men make it through, so an even smaller percentage of women will. But if someone does,
I think there's a misnomer, which is guys don't want women to be firemen or guys don't want women to be in SEALs teams. Every guy I know would just go, as long as the standards are the same, as long as you can climb a ladder with a 60-pound pack, so my kid weighs 60 pounds and you can get him down the second floor. As long as you do that, then nobody cares. Nobody cares. I think you hear about the standards being changed, and then
that's the problem.
Then folks object, and then you go, oh, you don't like women. And it's like, no, we don't like lower standard for a super important job.
Right when I was getting out, right around 2011 and 12, the big thing was the repealing of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The only people making a huge deal about it were the pundits on television. The guys over there in Afghanistan with me are like, I don't care. It doesn't matter. If they did the job and they're fighting, fine.
Well, what was all the – and I wonder how much this actually affected you guys, or if this was more just BS that everyone was talking about back here. But you can't have women on the front lines. You can't work with women because the men will be so over-sexualized, and that will be such an issue.
I don't see that. They try to put that in there, some psychological crap. I don't think that's a case at all. Like I said, I've been in fights with women there, and it's not it's more of a who's in a better tactical position. If someone's in trouble, I'm going to help that someone. That's all it is. And I don't think it would be other than me protect woman. Crap. I don't buy it. Anyway. But again, I'm not fighting right now, so I don't know how they feel, but that's how I feel.
All right. So we'll get into you have a few minutes. You grab everything you can grab, including the body. You go to a different chopper than Bin Laden's corpse, right? You land where?
They picked us up right outside the compound, and then we turned and started flying towards this is actually a pretty cool part of the story, because we get in the helicopter. We're flying 90 minutes to Afghanistan, again, on a mission we're supposed to die, but we realize if we make it – and we start the stopwatches, 90 minutes, and we live.
Right.
And, we're counting that stuff, and we're getting to 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and everyone's kind of looking around, but no one's talking because you don't want to jinx a no-hitter in the top of the sixth.
Right.
I'm not saying anything, but it's been 40 minutes, 50 minutes, 60 minutes. And then we got to, it's getting surreal. We get to 85 minutes, and then all of a sudden the pilot comes over the radio and says, all right, gentlemen, for the first time in your careers, you're going to be happy to hear this. Welcome to Afghanistan. And that's when it sinks in. It's like, holy crap, we did this. And then we landed. We got out. The other helicopter came in. We pulled the body out. The admiral was there. We showed it to him. The female analyst was there. And we kind of talked about stuff, and I don't want to ruin the book because I'm not allowed to say the language, but in the movie Zero Dark Thirty, they showed the female analyst the body, and she got emotional and cried and left, and the movie ended horribly, worst part of the movie. What actually happened is in the book, and it's hilarious, and it shows what a tough person she is. Very good story. Again, I tell it now, but I wouldn't do it justice without using the language she used, by the way. Hurt my ears a little bit, but she used it.
Now it's 4 a.m. or so. Yeah. So you have to be exhausted.
Yeah, we're pretty high on emotion. Adrenaline.
It's got to be a feeling of wanting to crack a beer and blow off a little steam.
Yeah, well, we flew them up to a different base that we'd kind of we'd built up a little bit since 9/11. So we had a different chalet we can go to with a pizza oven, and they had some adult beverages there. So we were able to partake a little bit before we flew back to Virginia Beach. It wasn't a big keg party, but we could sneak stuff into places. We just snuck into Pakistan. I'm hoping I could have snuck in a bottle of Jack Daniels.
So now, do they need to get you out of the region quickly? Is that a concern?
No, it wasn't a concern, but just because we'd gone over so abruptly, they just wanted to get us back. There was no reason for us to be there. There's already another team over there, as far as our team, and they just wanted to get us home. So, because it was going to be business as usual. We get back and we start training again for our next deployment. So, there was obviously dog and pony shows where we go see the higher ups and different principals, and then the president and vice president, things like that. Everybody in that famous picture too came to thank us except Hillary Clinton. That's odd. She must have had other stuff going on, I guess.
I got Benghazi questions as long as you brought that up. I want to know about the president, meeting the president, and what that vibe was like. And But I'm curious about what you think or know about Benghazi as well. Benghazi, I don't know what you know. I don't know if you knew any of those guys. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but I'm curious if you have any.
Well, I didn't know any of the guys there. I know some guys are indirectly involved. I'm familiar with the mission that was going on over there, and the biggest problem that I have with it is the cover up at the end when they lied to the families and they tried to, you know, say whatever it was, and it was because of a video, not because of a coordinated attack from Al Qaeda. There's a lot of problems there. One of which was not believing in bad guys. Political correctness has a belief because we're a consulate in Libya, the bad guys don't exist here. But there is no. There are no borders in the Levant. That's what ISIL was standing for, you know, Islamic State in Iraq and Levant. Levant spreads through Libya to Tunisia. So short answer is we're fighting Al-Qaeda there too. Same guy, same ideology. You got to be careful there. I wish a lot of the agency people that had security would have helped more. Unfortunately, there's not a team ready to roll to rescue people in every part of the world. And then you got to consider some of the guys that went to fight who were very, very brave in the fight they got into. I wasn't there. Nothing but respect for those guys, will to live, and just what they did. Having paid professionals there, there's international law you need to think about. I don't know if I can send these guys in to fight because, I mean, we got to uphold that kind of stuff. Horrible fight. I think the guys that fought, like I said earlier, they just fought for the guys next to them. I've seen 13 hours. I know some of the guys now that were there. The fight sounds horrific, and just 13 hours of fighting in a place like that where you're surrounded, overrun, like Alamo type stuff. Incredible fight. I just wish the administration would, instead of lying about it, they would have told the truth instead of Susan Rice going to every different Sunday show and just lying. It was a big problem.
Well, my thing is, before the lying, or before we knew the lying was lying, when Hillary Clinton was like, don't worry, we're going to get the guys who made that cartoon.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah, it's an issue.
I'm like, why do you care about the guy? We're not. I don't want to get the guys who made the cartoon. I want to be the guys who murdered these guys. It seemed insane to me, and I know there's a bunch of political correctness and insanity, but you're allowed to make cartoons. You don't have to kill people because someone made a cartoon about your god. The notion that we need to get the guys who made the cartoon. And not the guys who did the killing, the slaughtering, means we've jumped the shark politically. That's an insane statement. Don't worry, we're going to get the guys who made the cartoon.
Even though
in America, the land of free speech, like, that's an insane comment that
she
made.
Even though the guys with the cartoon or the video, whatever it was, have nothing to do with the attack, the fact that you would bring that up in a cover-up, even, you know, is nonsense, because that shouldn't be, I don't care about the cartoon, it's free speech. Yeah, exactly. I see what you're saying.
That was an insane comment to make, and I think she denied it.
An insane comment from a perfectly sane person, though.
I guess she denied she ever made the comment. But I guess there was some.
That reminds me of I heard a really good joke. What costs millions but's worthless? Second place in a presidential election.
Oh, that's a good one.
So it's kind of weird because I'm assuming there was a cover up or sort of an attempt at a cover up. I'm still not sure why there needed to be a cover up, but I guess the reason why do you think there needed to be a cover up?
I think a lot of things. I'm assuming the initial thing was they didn't want to admit what they were doing in the consulate because that's a sort of a spot, I think, where they're running guns into Syria. They're trying to do it out of there. They're putting guns somewhere, so it's like a covert thing. Then they don't want to admit that they had Americans in trouble. They really did nothing to help them. And then, you know, the admission that, the red line that we told not to cross, the bad guys are spreading everywhere because of our failed policies in places like Libya, in places like Syria, in places like pulling out of Iraq. You just want to pretend like we just stick our heads back in the sand, maybe it'll go away.
What is the difference between ISIS and Al-Qaeda?
Well, the difference is simply that ISIS was able to do the first thing that someone from that ideology has done, and that's that they actually established an Islamic state. They actually did it. They had a capital. They have a caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Same principles, same Wahhabist version of Sunni Islam that comes out of Saudi Arabia. All of them too, like Boko Haram in Africa, the Khorasan group. All these different fronts are all based on the same radicalized version of Sunni Islam, this certain part of Sunni Islam. So there's not really a big difference. Even parts of the Taliban, like even they say Taliban and ISIS are in Afghanistan, that's not the case. These ISIS guys are Taliban guys now that say they're ISIS. They just pledge allegiance to the caliph. That's all they're doing. So they're on the same side, and that's one group, and then you got the Iranians who are Shia on the other group, and they've been fighting since the split of the split of Islam, when it split off.
Is there, as someone who's experienced the culture and the people up close, are you optimistic? Or does it seem in everyone's muscle memory and DNA just to fight?
I'm getting more optimistic, because what we're going to need is a help from a lot of our Sunni allies. The Sunnis to deal with ISIS. The Sunnis aren't going to help us with Iran. Well, they would, but in a totally different way, that would be the right way to do it. But because I've seen people in places like Afghanistan that are from United Arab Emirates that are Sunni Muslims, but they yell at the Taliban. They're like, look, you can have Dubai and Islam. You don't need to do this crazy, archaic, 1,400-year-old nonsense. You don't need to do it this way. So, but we need help from those moderates, the people that can say we can have our religion, we can have our countries, but we can also have Western society be part of it. That's what we need. We need to get the clerics that are preaching the hate off the pulpit. We can't have one of the things that I always say is that a lot of the problems right now is that they're stealing the innocence of children, because they're teaching them to hate right off the bat. They have this thing you'll notice online, if you can stomach it, they have a thing called the Cubs of the Caliphate, where they're raising kids to be executioners. And if you're a 5-year-old kid cutting a live man's head off with a dull knife, you're not going to be normal in 10 years. So you need to get rid of the hate preach that's out there. And that's what they're doing, because they really believe in this version, and it's a way to get to heaven, that if we do this for the, you know, because they're trying to take over the world, we do this for the Prophet, for Allah, we're going to heaven eventually.
Is this worse than the catcalling that took place with this young lady walking through Manhattan? This was a 10-hour period. Now, I know cutting a guy's head off with a dull knife at 5 is bad, but what about Cecil the Lion?
Don't answer too quickly.
It's just, I mean, even
this is why I laugh about our problems. This is when they laugh about whatever.
It can be solved just with common sense. Like, I went to war a lot, and we're not going to win this by bombing people. We're going to need a lot of it, because these military-aged radicalized fighters that are, you know, 20 to 30 or whatever age they are that have been, they're not going to be, we can't bring them back. We're going to need to kill them or lock them up. But it's the kids we can save, and we're going to need help from the clerics.
Yes. I'm curious. I heard on a show one time, there, I believe it was Denmark, they tried this program. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but young people who were radicalized, I believe from Denmark, not originally, but they came back, instead of locking them up or interrogating them, they sort of, I don't want to use the word embrace them, but try to sort of de-radicalize them through having tea and having cookies and having these. I don't know if you have any thoughts on
it. Some thoughts on that too. I've had, you know, people that really want to martyr themselves for the cause to go to Allah are not going to have their belief changed by tea and cookies. And I've had interrogators tell me that, having talked to like tier one Al-Qaeda targets. The de-radicalization thing, I don't know. I mean, they could be so good at that, they're going to lie to you. You got to find who's preaching what and where, and it's got to be from inside the mosque. We're going to need help for that. I mean, if they can, I'd love it. And who knows? Maybe we take a bunch of them to Vegas. We're good to go. Maybe the white devil or whatever they call us, the great Satan's not that bad.
Oh, great Satan!
I've always,
that'd be a good band name.
Yeah, we're great, right in it, and just great white, and then we just put Satan in there.
Yeah, white Satan.
So this is the same thing. I think we get into trouble when we start with this precept, which is everybody loves their family, everyone wants to get along, everyone wants to see their 85th birthday. Nobody wants this, so there must be a reason why people are doing stuff. And I've always said we are so narcissistic that we go, we must have gotten them to do something. Like, there's a reason why they hate us. What are we doing? I don't know.
Well, that's the problem. That's what we're saying. But what a lot of they're saying, that we need to coerce them to be just like us. And if not, we kill them, or we make them pay a tax. But see, I mean, we are the same way, because it's like, well, we'll just go over there and we'll just enforce democracy. It's like, you can't do that. It has to come from within. Like, we've proven that before.
Yeah, and also, I think it, you know, you can go bomb Germany, you can bomb Japan, you can bomb Italy, and then you can put up a little puppet regime, get them back up on their feet, have a little military force, let them start selling some cars, and clear out. But that's a different culture. It's
way different culture, and you need to be over there to understand it. You need to see it up close to understand it. A lot of people, you know, we're losing the war in Afghanistan because we got politicians and lawyers involved. You know, and that's not the way it works. And even right now, when they're trying to raise it, oh, look, our well-trained Iraqi army just took Mosul from ISIS. No, they didn't. The Iranians did. So that's awesome.
Why is it that we never, or maybe, I mean, I'm incorrect, so you help me. Our plan is like train the locals, but we never seem to really coach them up the way they need to be coached up, and somehow they don't look right in their uniforms.
They're not.
They never look good in their uniform.
No, they can't. You ever seen the one of the Marines trying to teach the Iraqis how to do jumping jacks? I thought it was a joke until I went there.
Why wouldn't we be able to take just young, able-bodied 18-year-old guys, give them the right training, the right equipment, and go, now you do the job?
I mean, that's part of their culture. Everything they do is called inshallah, God willing. And that works opposite ways on our end. It's like, you know, hey, we'll be here tomorrow for workout at 7 a.m. Well, inshallah, they might show up, they might not. We might train, they might not, but they do sometimes because they get paid. On the other side, God wants them to destroy the infidel, so that's why they fight so hard. That's why they blow themselves up. So it's a cultural thing based on their religion, and when religion's all you know, it might be a bad – I mean, you might want to throw in like a trigonometry course every now and then or, you know, something.
God, it's just
it's fascinating, but it's scary.
It's fascinating, but it feels so unfixable. Because
it's going to take a lot of work.
Permeated everywhere. And then it's also, I feel the same way about certain districts and politicians and stuff, like where you just go, when is enough going to be enough where you just vote someone else in? Like you start going a different path. Like how many years are you going to vote in Maxine Waters before you just go, hey, poor people, this just ain't cutting it.
Let's
like
try
where
something
schools
else.
Suck or everything sucks, everything's in poverty. Like why? Four more years, or why another term? Like, at what point do you just go, I don't think this system is benefiting us. Like, I don't feel like there's a bunch of dirt on the floor. There's a scorpion up my ass. Like, I'm eating with my hands. Our schools suck. Like, at what point do you just go, let's, how are those Mormons doing? They seem to be doing pretty good over there.
They got some ideas we can incorporate.
I'm just saying, like, it's so weird that you think, like, doesn't there have to be some sort of saturation point for people? Like, I do feel that way with politics all the time, where you go, how long is this not going to work before you go, maybe we'll go another direction, and they just keep going with the same people until they die.
It's got to be the herd mentality. That's all it is. You know, we're going to, you know, we've always done this, so I'm going to keep doing it. My grandfather voted this way. And that, I mean, that's got to be the same.
I get it if you're being herded over some fertile pastures with lots of food and clean water. So you're just being herded into an ashtray. After years and years of years of just being herded into an ashtray, and the herder goes this way, at what point do you just break off and kind of go,
That's a good question. You would think it would happen.
It's weird. It's weird that the way civilizations, cultures, and humans are, I feel like this country, which is probably less broken than almost any other nation in terms of how we treat people, our system, you know, just the government, the murder rate, just whatever it is, whatever yardstick you use to measure a culture, we're probably less broken than many, many, many other cultures who treat their women or gays or whatever yardstick you use to measure this. We are constantly self-scrutinizing. We're constantly going, why aren't we changing? We should be changing more. We're not changing fast enough. It needs to happen more. Like we're under a magnifying glass that we put over our own anthill and decided we need to change. We need to change early. We need to change often. And we don't need that much changing, but we never stop talking about hope and change or we need to modify or we need to progress or we need to move forward. And then there's these cultures that have been flatlining for a million years that need nothing but change, and it's never discussed. So it's a weird thing, and it's also kind of a luxury. Like, I feel like we do this because the water's clean, and we're safe, and we have plenty of food, and we're soft, and we do just focus on us changing. And I'm not just saying us. Like, Australia does a lot of it. Like, they're putting themselves under their own magnifying glass, but how much change does Australia really need to do? And isn't it just a weird, out-of-problems, first-world imposing of this? This is way too this is way above any of our pay grades. But I'm now just thinking that, in a weird way, we probably talk more about changing than many cultures that actually need to change a ton, and we need to change 4%. God bless America. Gina.
I'm curious, and if you're comfortable talking about it, you've done this for so many years. You've been on so many missions. And I'm wondering if you've experienced or what your experience has been with PTSD, with people that you know dealing with that when they come home. American Sniper was so powerful when it came to that. And I think about this a lot, and I don't feel like we do enough to transition people back into society in a way that really helps them. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's true that we don't necessarily help transition too much. And that's simply because the military doesn't really have an interest in that because they're not going to come back to benefit them. As far as with PT, I don't consider it a disorder. I consider it just post-traumatic stress for sure. And a lot of guys get it. I've been very fortunate. Believe it or not, I've never seen a friend get hurt in front of me. Never had a friend get hurt on combat. I've had friends that have died that I'm very close with, but not when I was there with them. I've never seen a child get hurt. So I've been lucky. But I have friends that have and have seen friends die right in front of them in horrible ways. So they do have it, and we talk about it too. But part of the issue with PTS is that it's overdiagnosed. They want you to have it. So everyone that's been to combat, they want you. No, you definitely have it. You just denial. And the problem there is the people that actually have it don't get the treatment they need because they're trying to treat everyone, even people.
They're flooding.
And a lot of it, believe it or not, too, and a lot of vets won't tell you this, is because if you have PTSD or whatever they call it, you can get benefits. So even people that haven't seen combat, they can claim it and get money. And they do. So it's another problem with the entitlement society. Like you should have enough honor to say, look, I'm fine. Like I do. I don't have PTS. And I'm not getting any benefits for it. A lot of people don't do it that way. And so even with us, there are Marines out there now in Kandahar province walking through minefields. They have a job that's much more dangerous than anything I ever did because we could fight on our terms. They can't. So the young Marine, 20 years old, that wasn't trained to our level, sees three of his friends blown to hell. He's going to have an issue. He's the guy that needs the treatment. It's not the person back at the base. God bless them. Thanks for their service, but never left Green Bean Coffee. They don't need it. So it's definitely a real thing. And I'm happy that, we've come from a way, like in World War II, you're fighting at Bastogne in Battle of the Bulge. And then on Monday, you're working in the factory again because you should just do it.
Right.
We've come a long way, but right now we're almost too sensitive about it. We got to find the people that really haven't helped them. But a lot of us, like myself included, we don't need it.
Interesting.
Well, so there's a couple things. You've incentivized people to have it because you're going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then good luck any politician that says, come on, she was in the rear with the gear. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have
That's
nothing.
That's a good point. Very good point.
You're never
going to happen.
You can't take a stand. You can't tell someone they don't have it mm-hmm. if they say they have it. So between them getting paid to have it and you not being able to really vet it, because if you say you have it, you have it. There's nothing we can do. It's going to be a lot of people with it. I like the idea that you drop the D with the disorder part because – I always worry, and I talk to Dr. Drew about this all the time, like when they tell kids that they're hyper something or they have a reading disorder or an eating disorder, like just telling
attention
someone you have a disorder,
uh-huh.
what I mean? Like, could have some ADD and a dusting of Asperger's, and it's like, leave them alone. Like everyone's different. Does everyone have to have this rubber stamp of I'm defective, I have a disorder, I'm going to carry this around for the rest of my life? And I agree, you don't want to deny it.
Right.
But if somebody has been where they've been and seen what they've seen, then they're going to be changed by that. But does that mean that they carry this around for the rest of their life? And I like the idea of not putting this sort of label on it that says you're this way for the rest of your life.
That's a lot of the VAs want to do that. They want to get you in there, convince you you're nuts, put you on some pills, and send you out. It's not the way to do it. I mean, if you want to treat veterans, there's places out there. You get them together. There's a friend of mine, Eric Grimes, who's now the governor of Missouri, started a foundation. The Mission Continues, where he would get vets together and they would build houses. And that's just, a lot of them weren't carpenters, but you're just out there doing something, a product. And that's what gets people out of their, out of their room. So that, that's really good stuff there. And then the other thing is a lot of vets don't know what to do. As far as work, what am I going to do? We've been at war for so long. People don't – like I got out at 17 years. I didn't get a pension. I knew it was 20, but I'm not going to do 20. I'm good. We did these missions. I'm just going to get out, but I didn't know what I was going to do. I was fortunate to have some skills that the military taught me. The SEAL teams helped me to fine-tune, and I've met people that hired me. I actually started a foundation called Your Grateful Nation that helps veterans do that. Because they'll say, they'd rather go to combat than fill out a resume because combat makes sense. But once they realize they've learned how to solve problems, manage stress, work as a team, show up to work, loyalty, we'll find a company for them, and they will mentor that veteran for 9 months. All of a sudden, they have a job.
Wow. Well, I do have an idea about a possible transition thing, but you tell me if it's too marshmallow for you, because
mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about this for a while. If you're a combat veteran and you're coming home for whatever, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, there's like some really, really, really nice high-end spa where you're getting just a place to decompress with talk therapy, with individual therapy, with chilling out, hardcore, like appreciation.
I think they do stuff like that now too. I'm not sure if it's required, but there's stuff out there, and I think it would actually help a lot of people.
Thanks. I'm glad. Yeah. Let's talk more about that.
I can be the test case if I'll go right now.
But a really expensive high-end spa that's been converted.
We got a problem.
No.
Well, because they're not all in Afghanistan. Some go to like the Philippines.
Okay.
And those guys are different. They have a different idea of a spa experience. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And so those guys are going to actually
we will make concessions
suffer
for that.
PTSD Understood. If they don't get a happy ending.
Understood.
You know what I mean? Like that could send them further into a spiral.
Stress.
Well, again, they're used to this operation in a theater.
I think what you get there is PTSD. That's the thing that goes on there. That's it. Thank you. Doing what I can over here.
Wow, man. What a tale has been woven here today. I am so impressed, Robert.
Thank you.
And
we should have played blah, blah, blah with him.
Yeah. I love the stories. You come back and we'll ask you, we'll get all into Captain Phillips on that one. And rescuing Mark Wahlberg and everything. The operator firing the shots that killed Osama bin Laden. And my years as a SEAL team warrior. Available now on Amazon. Robert O'Neill is the name. Robert, man, this has been great.
Yeah, I've had a good time. Thanks. I appreciate you having me come out. This is awesome.
It's been all my pleasure. You can go to AdamCarolla.com. Live shows. I'm doing stand-up in Chicago and Minneapolis and Nashville and all over the country. Just go to AdamCarolla.com. We got the Mangria and we got our cruise and we got swag and we got buck slips and all that. So check that out. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Robert O'Neill, Gina Grand, Paul Bryan saying mahalo.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. The Ace Man, September 23rd, Chicago Park West. Music Hall in Minneapolis, October 13th. Nashville's James K. Polk Theater on October 14th. And come out to the Carolla Drinks Comedy and Music Show in Santa Barbara at Soho Restaurant and Music Club on August 22nd. Tickets and info at CarollaDrinks.com. For tickets to everything Adam Carolla, including the Carolla Cruise this November, visit AdamCarolla.com.